This change, however, following the defeat of Napoleon and the demobilisation of tens of thousands of men, many of whom were attracted to Tasmania by the promise of free land, others who made their way out here in chains. Either way, by the early 1820s, the settlement of Tasmania's interior was proceeding apace. The invasion of tribal lands was the ultimate cause of the Black War, but it wasn't its trigger. There was a 6-to-1 gender imbalance in colonial society. That's 6 men for every woman. And on the frontier, that was 16-to-1. Homosexuality and even bestiality was not uncommon. And not surprisingly, many frontiersmen resorted to abducting and raping Aboriginal women and children. And this, I would argue, was the main proximate cause of the war. As more and more colonists flooded in, Aboriginal attacks soared from 25 in 1824 to 260 in 1830. War parties torched dozens of properties, plundered hundreds of homes, speared thousands of sheep and cattle. Even more devastating was the human toll. 225 colonists killed, 228 wounded, and they were just the recorded ones. Per capita, that's a higher casualty rate than Tasmanians during World War II. Almost every colonist lost somebody they knew, while the war's 200 or so Aboriginal survivors, exiled to Flinders Island in the early 1830s, lost nearly everybody they knew, together with their country and their way of life. At first glance, this suggests a relatively uneven conflict. But most of the island's several thousand original inhabitants were not killed by white men directly, but by the disease, intertribal conflict, and general bedlam that they introduced. There is evidence for only around 280 direct killings of Aborigines during the war, and the true figure, allowing for underreporting, may have only been 2 or 3 times that. That's a casualty ratio of 2 to 3 to 1. Compare this to the mainland, which saw casualty rates in the low range of 10 to 1 and in the high range of 50 to 1, and you start to appreciate how effective the Tasmanians were at resisting colonisation. The problem was they couldn't replenish their numbers, while every colonist that was killed was replaced by 100 more. Both sides employed similar guerrilla tactics, but what made the Black War unique was the circadian rhythm of the violence. Aborigines, fearful of the evil spirits that lurked in the night, only ever attacked during the day. For their part, colonists were generally only able to ambush their victims at night. Every night, dozens of official and unofficial parties scoured the horizon for signs of campfires. Yet with every successful Aboriginal ambush, Aboriginal vengeance was redoubled. Thank you. And the fear of their attacks came to paralyse the young colony. And this is something that's missed when we focus only on the horrible things that happened to Aborigines. You can miss how effective they were and how much terror they struck into the hearts of Europeans. Dozens of settlers abandoned their farms, and in at least 2 cases, entire communities fled. In 1830, under intense pressure from colonists, Governor Arthur initiated a massive 7-week campaign involving 2,300 men, fully 10% of the colony's population, to hunt down the hostile tribes. The operation, which became known as the Black Line, remains Australia's largest ever domestic military offensive. It was also a complete fiasco. Shoes disintegrated within the first fortnight. Food drops, if they could be found at all, were rotten and infested. Torrential rain caused hypothermia. And trigger-happy linesmen shot more of their own comrades than they did Aborigines. Poor leadership and even poorer maps meant that parties were constantly lost. One even went 200 miles in the wrong direction and only avoided starvation by eating their knapsacks. If morale wasn't low enough from this, the Aborigines easily slipped through the line and began killing settlers and their families in the rear. To everyone's surprise, it was actually a religious zealot by the name of George Augustus Robinson and his savvy band of Aboriginal envoys who brought the war to an end by negotiating an armistice with the survivors. They probably didn't take much persuading though. By the end of the war, Aboriginal society in eastern Tasmania had been reduced to a single remnant mob, a hodgepodge of survivors from bands decimated by years of fighting. Their continued attacks were now more a matter of necessity than of principle, because it was often easier to steal their food than to hunt it when there were so many white men around. The survivors fought courageously, but now they were exhausted, and Robinson seemed to be offering them a way to end their suffering on their own terms. The 26 survivors accepted an armistice and returned to Hobart with Robinson, where they were promised an interview with the governor. On the 7th of January, 1832, and I still get tingles when I try to imagine this scene, the citizens of Hobart stopped what they were doing, and they lined themselves along Elizabeth Street as the heroes of the Black Resistance walked, weapons in hand, towards the governor's house. And there are a number of accounts that survive from this time, and they are truly haunting. And they go to show that these were not a people who were just massacred and wiped off the earth. These were a people who fought to the very end. They were sent to Flinders Island a week or so later, and many of them began to die quickly from introduced diseases at the Wibalena Aboriginal establishment there. After 15 years, the government decided that it wasn't worth funding such a small number, so the 46 survivors were removed from Flinders Island and transferred to an abandoned convict station just south of Hobart, where they continued to die. Indeed, it's nothing short of a miracle that we have Tasmanian Aborigines today, because the veterans of the war came terrifyingly close to leaving no surviving children. And it's a testament to the tenacity of this 40,000-year-old people that they did not die out. And as you can see, they are once again thriving. In my published work, I've attempted to tell the story of the Black War at the human level, leaving the ethics and legality of British colonisation and their treatment of the Aborigines to other historians. Instead, my focus has always been on the attitudes, experiences and behaviours of those involved. My book, The Black War, which is available over here, I wrote it every single chapter half from the black side, half from the white side, forcing the reader to empathise with both sides. The thing is, for me, morally judging these people is not only pointless, it's illogical. They lived in a totally different moral universe to us. The attitude of Governor Arthur, for instance, would be considered monstrous by today's standards. But 200 years ago, he was considered the epitome of a bleeding heart lefty, way too sympathetic with the Aborigines. So we have to put this stuff in context. Rather than waste time judging people who would have found our 21st century morality unintelligible, I believe we should simply try to understand and learn from them. Ultimately, I'm interested in the Black War because of what it tells us about the human condition. These were ordinary people placed in extraordinary circumstances who came to experience and often to perpetrate the most horrific acts. But this is also a story of courage and resistance, of solidarity and survival. The Black War was not, as it is often portrayed, a battle between good and evil. It was a battle between human beings constrained by the brutality and ignorance of their time. This history matters not just because it tells us who we were, but because it hints at who we are. We all like to imagine that we're somehow fundamentally different from the men who did the raping and killing on Tasmania's frontier, but we're not. Combine fear and ideology and a dash of ignorance, and our species' capacity for cruelty is unbounded. A thin veneer of circumstantial luck is all that separates us from our forebears. And so we must be wary of the primate within us, lest our luck run out. "He who forgets will be destined to remember," is a line from my favourite Pearl Jam song. In other words, if we don't learn from our history, we will be condemned to repeat it. In an increasingly overstrained and volatile world, these lyrics are more poignant than ever. Now more than ever, we must learn from our forebears' mistakes, just as we must learn from those who forged a rich and sustainable existence on this land for 40 millennia. Because only by candidly interrogating our past can we hope to navigate our future. And that's why it matters that our young Tasmanians understand the Black War.
Australia is a nation obsessed with war. Every town, no matter how obscure, has its war memorial. Our government spends obscene amounts of money commemorating and often celebrating our involvement in overseas conflicts. The already well-funded Australian War Memorial, for instance, just received another $500 million of federal funds. Much of this money will be spent feeding the myth that our nation shed its adolescence on the shores of Gallipoli. And at the end, that spirit encapsulates what it really means to be Australian. This is rubbish.
World War I was a pointless waste of life. World War I was a pointless waste of life. We should never have been there. Victory brought us nothing but cemeteries. The Black War, by contrast, is our island's most important conflict. But don't waste your time looking for reminders of it in our public spaces. There's not a single official memorial. For that matter, there's not a single official memorial to frontier conflict anywhere in Australia. The struggles of the Tasmanian Aborigines deserve to be commemorated. Armed with just spears and clubs, they put up the stiffest resistance of any Indigenous people anywhere in Australia. They fought to the very end, until scarcely 24 of them remained. Among them were many individuals worthy of our commemoration and admiration. Men like Tonga Longora, the revered warrior who cut off his own arm after it was shattered by a musket ball and drove it into the fire to cauterise the wound. He survived a normally fatal injury and went on to lead his people through the remainder of the war and into exile. But have you ever heard of him? We know exactly where he's buried, but his grave and the graves of the other heroes of the Black War are not marked by elaborate memorials. They're marked by weeds. More controversially, I also feel that we will eventually need to find some way of, if not commemorating, at least remembering the white victims. On the face of it, this sounds at best odd or at worst insulting. But most of these people were convicts, born into poverty and transported for trivial offences, only to meet their deaths in a strange land at the hands of an even stranger enemy. Struggling farmers like Patrick Goff, who lost his wife, daughter, neighbour and home to Aboriginal violence. Or large landowners like Bartholomew Thomas, who was killed along with his overseer during a good faith attempt to open a peaceful dialogue at Port Sorell. No doubt he went to his grave ignorant of the true impact that his intrusion had had on his killers. Some colonists had never held a gun, much less fired it at an Aborigine. Others had killed their black enemies at every opportunity. But in a very real sense, they were all victims of circumstance. And regardless of their guilt or innocence, these stories of these luckless men and women are pivotal to our history. And I think it's important that we learn what they have to teach. Almost done. I'm sure it's only a matter of time before the Australian War Memorial and the state and federal governments, you still here, Will? Thank you. Come around to commemorating the Black War and memorialising its victims. And when it does, like with gay marriage before it, we'll shake our heads in disbelief that something so obviously right took so bloody long. One obstacle to commemoration is that it implies an equally difficult question. Shouldn't the Australian government, or at least the Governor General, apologise for the invasion, murder and dispossession of Aboriginal people? Many people assume that Kevin Rudd's apology did this, but that was solely to the Stolen Generation. Apologies of this kind are often dismissed as mere symbolism. But this couldn't be further from the truth. Just think of how powerful an apology can be in your own lives, whether offered or accepted. It's not just cathartic to say sorry, it resets the relationship and clears the path forward. At least 100,000 Aborigines died in frontier conflict. 100,000. Apologising for it would not be mere symbolism for those still reeling emotionally and socioeconomically from this trauma. Only good can come from acknowledging and apologising for this history. John Howard famously sought to keep our historical skeletons locked in the closet for fear that it would undermine our national pride. I don't know about you, but I'd feel a hell of a lot prouder to be Australian if my country openly acknowledged this history. Thank you.